Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear a story from Anna Mateo and Jonathan Evans. Later, Steve Ember will bring us this week's Making of a Nation report. But first, Wissem Gamra felt very different from other students when he began studying at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Gamra was born in Sousse, Tunisia. He lived there until he was 17 years old. But in his third year of high school, he learned of a chance to study at an organization called the African Leadership Academy. The African Leadership Academy is a special school in Johannesburg, South Africa. It trains students from across the continent to become future leaders who work to solve problems in Africa. It also helps students find money so they can pay for an education at top universities around the world. So, in 2012, Gamra went to Johannesburg to complete his high school education. Then he sought admission to Yale University to study electrical engineering. Yale is a private research university created in 1701. It is also an Ivy League school, meaning it is one of 8 private colleges and universities in the northeastern United States. The 8 are widely considered to be some of the best schools in the world.
Ivy League schools only accept a small number of students from among the thousands who seek admission. When Yale accepted Gamra in 2014, he became its first ever undergraduate student from Tunisia. Gamra says he faced some difficulties in dealing with the cultural differences between his homeland and the United States. For example, drinking alcohol at parties is common for many American college students. But many Tunisians are Muslim, and Islam has strong rules against drinking alcohol. Also, Gamra says some Americans have misunderstandings about developing countries. For example, during his first year at Yale, Gamra went to dinner with the parents of one of his American friends. After the meal, his friend's mother told Gamra how sad it was that people in the U.S. waste so much food while people living in other countries starve. Then she gave him the leftover food from their meal. Gamra thought she did this because she thought he did not have enough money for food, which he found a little insulting. Yet Gamra says this was just one bad example. He worked hard to make more American friends and share greater understanding of his culture. He did so by joining different student organizations at Yale. He is a member of Bulldogs Racing. This group of students spends an entire year building a race car to compete against teams from other universities. Also, Gamra joined Bulldog Productions. This is a Yale undergraduate student-operated film and theater production group. Gamra says he never did anything involving theater before coming to the United States. But he started designing theater sets when he joined Bulldog Productions in his first year. And in fall 2016, he was the lead producer of a musical production called Dracorian.
Melissa Castera says she chose Yale University because of the opportunities it provides to students outside their main field of study. She began working toward a master's degree in environmental management in 2015. Castera is from the town of Santo, Uruguay. She earned her undergraduate degree in civil engineering from the University of the Republic in Montevideo in 2008. Several years later, she decided she wanted to have an international experience to expand her understanding of the world. So, Castera decided to seek a Fulbright scholarship. This is a program supported by the U.S. Department of State. It gives money to American students and professors to study and teach in other countries. It also gives money to international students and professors who want to study and teach at American colleges or universities. Since she began studying at Yale, Castera says she has welcomed the difficulty of the work. She already had learned a lot about planning cities and development from her undergraduate studies. She chose to study environmental management because she wanted to learn more about how to protect water resources. But her program at Yale has forced her to learn about so much more, including politics and economics. Castera says that by examining other fields of study, she has had to think in ways she never had to before. And the ways in which she has had to use that knowledge, including public speaking, have pushed her out of her comfort zone. Now she feels she can express herself more in English and in Spanish. Yale has also provided Castera with the chance to see the world as she had not seen it before. As part of her program, the school required her to serve as an intern. So last summer, she joined the World Resources Institute to research water usage in Brazil. And in the spring of 2017, she went on a school trip to Israel and the Palestinian territories to study how they deal with water disputes. After completing her education, Castera says she wants to work to solve problems related to climate change. This is an issue she says she never knew much or thought about before coming to Yale.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. In the English language, some animals have come to represent human characteristics. Lions are brave, foxes are tricky, and elephants are loyal, just to name a few. Then there are chickens.
The English language has many chicken idioms and expressions, and for the most part, none of them represent anything good. For example, a chicken can describe someone who is scared or afraid. Children commonly tease each other about being chicken. They often use actual chicken noises to make the teasing even more descriptive.
The phrasal verb chicken out has a similar meaning. If you chicken out, you decide not to do something because you are too scared.
There are other ways in English to insult someone using chicken expressions. If you are running around like a chicken with its head cut off, you are acting in a crazy way. This comes from the gruesome fact that sometimes when a chicken's head is cut off, its body can still run around before it dies.
You can use this expression in many situations. Let's say you are planning a big party for a friend. You are in charge of inviting guests, choosing the food and drinks, decorations, and entertainment. So you are in charge of everything.
The day of the party comes, and things start going wrong almost immediately. The florist sends funeral flowers instead of the bright party flowers you ordered. The food you ordered is frozen and will not be ready for at least another day. The drinks are warm because you don't have enough ice. And the lead singer of the band is sick.
You run around like a chicken with its head cut off, trying to fix all the problems. When the food delivery man hands you a bill for the food no one can eat yet, you tell him you can't read it. His handwriting is like chicken scratch. If someone is a really messy writer, you can compare their handwriting to the markings that chickens make on the ground with their feet. We call that chicken scratch.
If someone is old, we can say they are no spring chicken. This expression is informal and could be insulting, so use it with care. Most importantly, we always use this expression in the negative. You would not call someone who is young a spring chicken.
This leads us to another chicken idiom. This one is not an insult, but it does describe a bad situation. What happens when your chickens come home to roost? First, what is to roost? To roost means to settle down for rest or sleep. We usually use it when talking about birds. Chickens usually return to their homes to rest. When we say your chickens have come home to roost, we are saying that your past wrongdoings have returned to negatively affect you. In this expression, the chickens represent the things that you did wrong in your past. Like we said earlier, we usually use chicken in a negative way. Well, except with this last example. You may have heard people ask, which came first, the chicken or the egg? We ask this question when talking about a cause and effect relationship between two things where we don't know which happened first. What is the cause and what is the effect? We often shorten it to simply chicken and egg. You can call something a chicken and egg situation or a chicken and egg problem.
I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week, our series brings us to the events of 2008. It was a year that combined one of the nation's worst financial crises with one of its most exciting elections in recent history. In 2006 and 2007, the American housing market began to collapse. Home values had been going up and up. Now the balloon burst. people started losing homes they had bought with money borrowed on easy credit terms, loans they were then unable to repay. The hope was that the crisis in the housing market could be contained and that it would not spread to the wider economy. Traditionally, local banks would have suffered the losses on the bad loans. But times had changed. Big investment banks had been buying those loans. The investment banks then resold them as securities offering high returns. Credit rating agencies working for the investment banks had told investors that the securities were safe. Selling a financial product based on a large group of loans was supposed to limit the risk if a few loans went bad. That was the idea. But that was before millions of homeowners stopped paying their mortgage loans. Mortgage-backed securities became known as toxic assets. No one wanted to be anywhere near them. In March of 2008, Bear Stearns became the first investment bank to fail as a result of the crisis. Others followed. In September, Lehman Brothers, the nation's fourth largest investment bank, sought protection in bankruptcy court. Its failure only deepened the fears in credit markets. Toward the end of 2008, an international credit freeze developed. No one wanted to take the risk of lending money to banks or other companies that might have owned toxic assets. Some people feared that there could even be a global depression, the first since the 1930s. The United States economy, the world's largest, started shrinking at the end of 2007. The unemployment rate started rising. President George W. Bush's administration, Congress, and the central bank, the Federal Reserve, took extraordinary steps to deal with the growing financial crisis. Their efforts included loans to banks, automakers, and other companies. The aim was to rescue businesses that officials considered too big to fail. The bailouts from Washington were a decision that not all of the American people agreed with. But the people also had to make a decision of their own in 2008. It was a presidential election year, and the candidates were some of the most diverse in the nation's history. The Republican Party nominated Arizona Senator John McCain. At 72, he would have taken office as the nation's oldest first-term president.
So stand up with me, my friends. Stand up and fight for America, for her strength, her ideals, and her future. The contest begins tonight.
John McCain had been a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War. In 1967, the North Vietnamese shot down his plane and took him prisoner. He was tortured and held for more than 5 years. He returned home a hero. During the presidential campaign, he spoke often about his experience as a prisoner of war. His campaign message was, "Country first." Senator McCain quickly secured the Republican nomination to succeed George W. Bush. The Democrats needed more time to choose a nominee. The race settled on two leading candidates. One of them was Hillary Clinton. Her husband was former President Bill Clinton. They spent 8 years living in the White House. As First Lady, she held an unusually public role in her husband's administration. Later, she was twice elected as a senator from New York. Now she was trying to return to the White House, this time as the first woman president of the United States.
So if you want a winner who knows how to take them on, I'm your girl.
The other leading candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination would also make history if elected. He was a first-term United States senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. He was born in Hawaii to a white mother from Kansas and a black father from Kenya. If he won, he would be America's first black president. Blacks in the United States had been slaves until 1863. They were not permitted to vote until 1870. Women in the United States did not have a constitutional right to vote until 1920. And not until the 1960s did federal civil rights laws bar discrimination against either group. During the nominating fight between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, there was a lot of discussion and debate in America about gender and race. Some talked about the problems that women still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a woman as president. Others talked about the problems that blacks still faced in society and wondered whether Americans could accept a black man as president.
I think we're ready. Well, I hope we're ready.
I just hear people comments, yeah, you know, that'll be the day when we have a black man running our country, yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Candidate Obama gave a speech about race in America.
I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one.
Many political experts predicted that Barack Obama would lose the nomination. For one thing, he was still new to many Americans, while almost everyone knew who Hillary Clinton was. Also, she had many wealthy supporters donating to her campaign. But political scientist Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia said those experts did not understand the country's mood.
They underestimated the power not just of Barack Obama, but also the yearning for change and the antipathy toward dynasty. The idea that the Bushes and the Clintons would essentially control the presidency from 1988 to potentially 2016.
Hope and change became the messages of the Obama campaign. Barack Obama won enough delegates to secure his party's nomination, which he accepted in August, shortly after his 47th birthday. His choice for vice president was Joe Biden, a longtime senator from Delaware. But Mr. Obama's nomination was not the biggest news story for long. The next day, John McCain had a big announcement of his own. His running mate would be Sarah Palin. The Democrats had once nominated a woman for vice president, Geraldine Ferraro, but never the Republicans. Neither party had ever nominated a woman for president. Sarah Palin was the 44-year-old governor of Alaska. Few Americans had ever heard of her until she spoke at the Republican nominating convention. She referred to herself as a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Some women said they admired her ability to balance work and family as the mother of five children.
I feel like she really speaks for me and represents me.
During the campaign, Barack Obama raised a record amount of money for a candidate, about $745 million. He became the first candidate to reject the modern system of public financing of presidential elections. Instead, he accepted smaller contributions from hundreds of thousands of supporters. His campaign made extensive use of the internet to collect donations, connect with voters, and organize volunteers. John McCain did not have as much money to spend. Something else also set him apart from the Democratic nominee. John McCain supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Barack Obama said he would bring the troops home from Iraq within 2 years of becoming president. But the top issue in the campaign was the economy. Again, Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia.
The fundamental issue in most presidential elections is the economy. It really is the economy, stupid, the old slogan from the 1992 Clinton campaign. When an administration has a positive, strong economy, they're tough to beat, even if it's a non-incumbent running. But when the economy turns sour, they're halfway out the door.
Barack Obama and John McCain agreed on at least one thing in dealing with the economy. They both supported President Bush's call for the government to bail out the financial industry. Many Americans disliked the idea of helping banks that had acted irresponsibly. But Congress agreed to let the government buy bad loans from banks and temporarily become part owner of some rescued companies. Supporters argued that the bailouts were needed to save the economy from collapse. In November of 2008, Americans elected Barack Hussein Obama as their 44th president. He received 53% of the popular vote. He won some states that had not chosen a Democrat in many years. A little more than 60% of voting age Americans cast their ballots, the highest percentage since 1964. Support for Barack Obama was especially strong among young people and African Americans. Many voters were emotional on election night.
I'm speechless. I'm trying not to cry right now. I'm thinking of my great-grandfather, my grandmother, and man, this is amazing.
Because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
But the election of 2008 was not the end of America's economic problems. What became known as the Great Recession would officially end in June of 2009, 6 months into the new president's term. But its lasting effects would continue to be felt all the way into the 2012 election season.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.